Joey, Lydia continued. We both know about Joey. Mrs. Patel went pale, then began shoving her mop over the checkered floor, kicking a wheeled yellow bucket before her. A gumball machine rattled when she mopped its base. Please close the door behind you when you leave, Lydia. Joey just wanted a family. Mrs. Patel nodded grimly, then she plunged her mop into the bucket, stirring gray waves. Lydia stepped forward and gripped the handle. Please sit, Lydia said, and gestured toward the old booth where she and Raj had spent so many childhood hours. The speckled formica, the creamer bottles, the sugar spouts were all the same.
Rohan will be back soon, Mrs. Patel said. You cannot be here when he arrives.
Then please start talking. Or we can wait for him and talk Ben. I could even call Raj over. He's really upset.
You have no idea.
Mrs. Patel, please. Mrs. Patel had recently washed the tables, and they were still slightly damp and smelled of bleach. She expertly ripped a few napkins from the cubed dispenser and dried the surface beneath their arms. Once she settled in across from Lydia, she didn't say anything for a minute, just stared out at the traffic on Colfax and nodded, as if finally giving herself permission. It started with a haircut. A young mother with a baby on her hip had come into Gas and Donuts one slow afternoon when Raj was starting fourth grade, and as Maya Patel filled her box of donuts, she found herself strangely drawn to her. The woman was slender, with skin the color of coffee, and she wore a gold-colored waitress uniform as if it were a gown. Her hair was shaved nearly bald, and she had big plastic hoops dangling from her ears. The woman cooed to her baby as Maya rang her up, and after she left, Maya watched her stroll up Colfax until she became small and disappeared. The woman had seemed so tall to Maya, so proud. She seemed to know exactly who she was. For the next few days, Maya was unable to clear this woman's presence from her mind, and soon she felt an urgent need to do something with herself. She'd always had long, lush hair, and spent 15 minutes every morning and evening brushing it out, and she was careful to only use shampoos with scents that appealed to Rohan. He was a big fan of her hair, though he only showed it about once a week, when he made love to her, leaning on his elbows and immersing his face within it, sometimes even holding it between his teeth like a ribbon as he emptied himself inside her. Many times Maya had caught Rohan watching the women of Colfax, especially the ones who went braless in the sun or who wore short skirts and quirky sandals, and she convinced herself that he would be pleasantly surprised if her appearance was to take a bold shift in their direction. She wouldn't wear a tank top, or anything too slinky, but she did buy a pair of Jordache jeans to wear instead of, or perhaps beneath, her sari, and even visited the stylist at the Glamour Guru salon down the street. He ran his comb through her hair, studied her from different angles, and recommended going short. Very short. Mrs. Brady short. Dorothy Hamill short. Maya shuddered, but agreed. During those first days after the haircut, when Maya and Rohan passed each other behind the donut shop counter, he would barge through the space and make her step to the side, or he'd lift his hands, palms out, as if she were contaminated.
I didn't marry a boy, he told her. We'll share a bed again when your hair is long.
These were his words to his wife of a dozen years, the mother of his child. Here she thought he would be aroused, but instead this marked the beginning of a long famine in their bedroom. Many of those nights, she slept alone on the couch. A month or so after the haircut, in the depths of her marital misery, the corroded pipes in the donut shop crawlspace burst. This was in the fall, long before the first deep freeze of the season, and Bart O'Toole spent the next 2 days working beneath the floors, lugging around his toolbox in that quiet way of his, and carrying lengths of copper pipe in and out of the storage pantry where the hatch to the crawlspace was located. Rohan was at his side for most of the work, making sure he got the job done right, yet Bart still managed to throw looks at Maya all the time. She wasn't sure if Rohan ever noticed, but she certainly did. Every time she turned around, this handsome, soft-spoken man was looking at her, but it felt more like an offering than a stare, as if he were rolling his gaze gently at her feet and asking her to pick it up. For so long in her relationship, Maya had felt herself teetering between invisibility and repulsion, and here was this lean, blonde man with blue eyes and a mustache, the opposite of Rohan, she thought, pouring his desire on her. She felt like that woman on television, the one in the street throwing her hat in the air. When the work was finally finished, Rohan inspected the job and clapped Bart on the back, and that was supposed to be it. But early the next morning, before the shop had even opened, and just after Rohan had left to drop Raj at school and pick up a new spray arm for the dishwasher, Bart O'Toole knocked on the glass door. 3 minutes later, he was in the crawl space, clanging around with his hammer and flashlight, and his toolbox sat on the floor outside the hatch. The shop would be opening in 20 minutes, and there was work to be done up front, yet Maya poured him a cup of hot coffee, the first pot of the day, then crouched on the floor next to the crawl space. Bart was on his back on the cold dirt in there, directly beneath some junction between pipes, trying to unstick an old valve that he'd soaked with penetrating oil the last time he was there.
"Nothing urgent," he assured her, "just a precaution."
Maya found that from where she crouched, she could see him from the neck down, and as he inched his way deeper into the crawl space, his shirt shifted and his belly became exposed, its faint trail of hair disappearing under his Coca-Cola belt buckle. Just as she was about to look away, she realized with a ripple of pleasure that she didn't need to look away at all, that because of the angle of the crawl space, he couldn't see her seeing him. And she wondered if this was like the nudie booth she'd heard about at the adult shops down Colfax, the ones she was sure Rohan visited, where the men could drop in quarters and peer into two-way mirrors and see naked women on old blankets and red pillows, bobbing to music, and the women couldn't see the men out there at all. Above the clang of pipes, Maya watched Bart's slender body for what felt like a long time, until, without warning, he'd scooched toward the opening and caught her consuming him with her gaze.
"Coffee," she blurted, and handed the lidded paper cup in his direction.
He sat up on an elbow.
"I don't get this kind of service at home," he said.
"That's for sure."
"At home?
Psh!
Who does?"
Bart took the coffee from her and screwed it gently into the cool dirt inside the crawl space, but Maya's small hand remained extended, and he studied her fingers for a long time before reaching out and touching them. Within seconds, they were on the tiled kitchen floor, mouth to mouth, breathing hard and fitting themselves together. The crawl space hatch was sealed shut, and Bart was out the door with his toolbox a full 3 minutes before Gas and Donuts opened. After, Maya thought she would feel guilty or terrified, yet all day long she could feel herself smiling, and when she closed her eyes, she could still feel Bart sliding tightly inside her, his hands clutching the back of her head, right where her hair was the shortest. A few times she went into the kitchen and stood over the tiled space, as if to remind herself of their union. One of those times, Rohan appeared right behind her.
"Customers!"
He clapped hard in her ear, startling her out of her trance. And that was basically it for Maya and Bart. There was one other encounter, a few days into October, a snapshot of late-night stupidity in the front of Bart's plumbing truck in the lot behind the shop while Rohan was doing his nightly bank drop-off. Maya's sorry got caught on a door latch and ended up with a small tear and a grease stain that would never fully come out, and Bart had clearly been drinking beer, and their sex felt awkward and ugly, more like an invasive trip to the doctor than a sensual tryst, and that marked the end of the affair, if these two encounters could even qualify as such. Months passed, Maya's misery remained. When she realized she was pregnant, she went into a panic and did everything she could to seduce Rohan, to try to blur the calendar in his mind, but her hair was growing slowly, and he was adamant about their abstinence.
"When you stop looking like a boy," he reminded her.
Maya didn't go to the doctor, didn't tell a soul. Mrs. Patel's eyes widened at the sound of a car splashing through the alley behind the shop. She appeared relieved when it moved on.
"Rohan will be here soon."
She scooted out of the booth and grabbed her keys from her sweater pocket.
I want to know what happened with Joey, Lydia said. If you know Joey, you know the rest. I went away. I had a baby. I gave him up. I came back. Now please, I have to finish.
Mrs. Patel was clearly upset. She fiddled through her key ring but never singled one out.
Will you exit out the back, please? She said. I can't have Rohan driving up and seeing you through the windows. I don't need the anguish, Lydia. Out of nowhere you come in here, digging through our lives. Please, just leave.
Lydia was feeling fogged by the confrontation and saddened by Mrs. Patel's predicament. Yet she couldn't shake the feeling that she was missing something, an elusive fragment that she couldn't pin down. She wasn't sure what else to do, so she followed Mrs. Patel past the empty display cases and coffee pots and through the kitchen's swinging door. Only half of the lights in the kitchen were on. She remembered its stainless steel counters, its stacks of silver bowls, its walls of white tile, but it seemed far more dingy now, and everything was filmed with grease. Marching solemnly behind Mrs. Patel, she was bothered by how this visit had turned out, and was thinking she should probably call. On the counter next to the deep fryer sat an assortment of cleaning supplies. Lydia stopped walking. Mrs. Patel stopped as well.
Lydia, please. He'll be here.
Just near a mound of rags, Mr. Patel had left one of his frayed hairnets, a squirt bottle of degreaser and another of vinegar, a wire scrub brush, and the pair of wadded latex gloves he always used to clean the fryer's racks and frame. Lydia's memories rolled over each other like pieces of glass in a kaleidoscope. She could picture Mr. O'Toole's name typed inside a tiny box and tucked into a file downtown, Bartholomew Edward O'Toole, Joey's father, Mrs. Patel's lover.
I know.
She could picture Mr. Patel in the slush outside a little while ago, walking in front of his headlights with a window scraper in his grip.
I know.
She could see the hammer man's hand slapping off the light switch.
I know.
His hairy wrist tucked into a white latex glove.
I know.
His white latex glove gripping a hammer.
I know, she said, barely audible. There isn't time for this, Lydia. This way. I know what your husband did. Lydia.
Her thoughts came so fast and with such force it was hard to contain them with her voice. She heard herself begging, "Tell me." She clung to the edge of the counter to stop herself from falling.
"Tell me."
Mrs. Patel went pale and covered her mouth with her gauzy hand.
"Tell me now, or I'll get Raj and you can tell him."
At 3 months along, Maya had begun to wear looser clothing and had found ways to hide her nausea, but she still hadn't told a soul about her pregnancy. Not Bart O'Toole, and certainly not her husband. But that would change one evening in January, just at the start of the biggest cold snap of the season. The stock show was going on over at the Coliseum, and there were more pickup trucks than usual carving through the snow on Colfax, and even more drunk cowboys waiting for the bus in sheepskin jackets. It was long after dark, and the three Patels were at Gas and Donuts hours after closing because the barbecue depot down the block had had a surprise visit that morning from a food inspector. Rohan was concerned that they would be inspected next. As Maya scrubbed every surface and double-checked expiration dates in the pantry and fridges, Rohan lowered himself into the crawl space to make sure that the pipes that Bart O'Toole had replaced a few months before were holding up against the cold. Raj had been very gloomy lately, upset by Carol's pushy takeover of his best friend, and tonight was especially bad because Lydia and Carol were having a sleepover and hadn't invited him. Maya grew so tired of the complaining that she made Raj go out and clean up the trash around the dumpsters in the alley. As he stepped out the back door, Maya could see snow tumbling through the lamplights, and when she turned around, Rohan was emerging from the crawlspace hatch, holding two items in his hands. In his left, the cold cup of coffee Bart had screwed into the earth, untouched these past 3 months. In his right, the hammer that Bart, in his horny haste, had accidentally left in the crawlspace. As Rohan straightened out and stared at her with icy silence, Maya realized that she was cupping her belly, as if to protect the life growing inside. Rohan clearly suspected that Bart had been there, in that dark and quiet place, without him, which meant that Maya had been there in that dark and quiet place, with Bart. Maybe because of this, the words poured out of her before she could stop them. "I'm pregnant." Rohan looked confused for a minute, just as he did when he was puzzling over the columns of digits in his account binders. He seemed bigger than usual, wider through the shoulders. He pointed toward the bump of her belly with the hammer in his hand.
"Are you sure?" he said.
"Fairly, yes."
Rohan looked at the small initials scratched into the base of the hammer, B-E-O.
"Mr. O'Toole?"
"Yes, 3 months, about."
"Bart O'Toole?"
"I've been planning on telling you. I was thinking I could take Raj somewhere for a while, until..."
"Take Raj?"
"Just for a while. I was thinking..."
"And go away? No."
For months, Maya had been anticipating this conversation, and she'd always envisioned it as being more chaotic, more dangerous. But Rohan was so calm and cold, it was as if he was storing up his energy. It felt strange to wish he was more upset.
"How many times," he said, "with you and him?"
"Only twice."
Rohan stretched out his arm and touched the flat head of the hammer to her abdomen and began to press, gently at first, then with a slight springiness, as if stoking a fire.
"Only."
"Rohan, please."
She tried to step back, but he followed her belly with the hammer, taking slow steps toward her, and she could feel its cold metal against her tummy and its forked end sharp through her shirt. He was pressing with more force now, and she was feeling nauseous and scared, really scared. But in that instant, Raj shoved open the back door of the shop and came trundling into the kitchen, eating a dumpling of snow out of his woolly glove. Maya and Rohan watched him glide through and disappear into the seating area out front. Maya believed that if Raj had not chosen that moment to come in from the alley, Rohan would have killed her then and there. Instead, he dropped the old cup of coffee in the trash and went into the storage room for a new hairnet and a flashlight and a pair of the latex gloves he used for cleaning. When he came out, he was wiping the hammer's handle on the sleeve of his coat.
"Where are you going?" she said to his back.
He yanked open the shop's rear door and became a dark silhouette against the glow of falling snow.
"Somebody's daddy forgot his hammer," he said.
Chapter 27
"Carol wasn't supposed to be there," Mrs. Patel said, pulling a Kleenex out from beneath her stretchy watch band and holding it to her nose. "I don't know what happened in that house, Lydia. I don't want to know. But I do know that Carol was supposed to be at your house, not there. It's all Raj talked about, being left out of your sleepover."
Lydia leaned into the stainless counter, feeling like she'd swallowed her tongue. Across from her in the donut shop kitchen, Mrs. Patel picked threads off her bandaged hand and dropped them to the tiled floor. The sight made Lydia dizzy, as if she too were unraveling. She looked around, and nothing was what it had always been. The buzzing industrial fridge, the dripping sprayer above the sink, the stovetop with its faint blue pilot lights, all of it was a grainy version of itself. The world she'd known for all these years was not the world around her.
"You need to sit," Mrs. Patel said, and slid an upturned bucket toward her feet, but Lydia shook her head.
Mrs. Patel opened the back door and propped it partway with a brick. Out there, the alley was sloppy and dark.
"Then you need some air."
Lydia's clothes were still damp, and the fresh chill seeped through her skin. She thought about how so many people, Moberg chief among them, had spent years seeking an answer to the Hammer Man, and the whole time it had been sealed in a file, waiting to be brought into the light. Birth father's name, Bartholomew Edward O'Toole. This single bit of data could have broken the case, except it hadn't even been recorded until Joey's birth in Colorado Springs, 6 months after the murders. No wonder Moberg had missed it.
You knew all along what your husband had done.
Only after, Mrs. Patel hissed, I had no idea what he was going to do. I'm not even sure he knew what he was going to do. Not exactly.
The day after the murders, Mrs. Patel learned about them by gluing herself to the local news channel. Her first thought was to turn Rohan over to the police, but in a fog of fear and panic, she reasoned that doing so would only hurt Raj. She convinced herself that it would be better for her boy to live a false life, under the adoring gaze of his father, than to live under the odious shadow of what he had done, and equally important, what she herself had caused.
"Because make no mistake, Lydia," Mrs. Patel said, "all of this was my fault. Their blood was on my hands. Make no mistake about that."
Mrs. Patel seemed as if she was about to shriek or curl into a crying fit, but instead she turned and brushed some remnant flour off the counter behind her.
"Please, just let this go, Lydia."
"I can't do that."
"You are alive," Mrs. Patel said. "Maybe you've never thought about the risk he took by not killing you."
"He walked into that kitchen covered in blood," Moberg had told her, "holding a dripping goddamned hammer, and let you keep your life."
"Of course I've thought about that," Lydia said, sickened. "And what about Raj?" Mrs. Patel said. "Do you understand what it will do to him if he finds out?"
"When he finds out? I do."
"You say you do," she said, shaking her head, "but you don't. You have no idea how bad this will be for him."
Mrs. Patel slumped forward, apparently resigned. Lydia could hear traffic splashing past on Colfax.
"You're not protecting your son, Mrs. Patel. You're protecting your husband, the Hammer Man."
"I am protecting my family," she said, as if her silence were a maternal duty.
Mrs. Patel peered out to the alley, checking for her husband's car. Then she moved the brick and closed the door and sat on a bucket near the dishwashing station. Lydia's mouth was parched and her ears were ringing, but she forced herself to focus.
"When did you decide to track Joey down?" she asked.
Mrs. Patel looked at her strangely and furrowed her brow.
"When did I decide? You've never had a child, Lydia, otherwise you wouldn't ask me that. I decided the moment he left my arms."
Something changed in Maya as she held her newborn in the delivery room in Colorado Springs. Joey had coppery skin and a head of soft black hair, and he smelled more lovely than any flower on earth. Though he'd only been outside of her body for minutes, he seemed so attuned to her presence, so alert. She knew that in giving him up she was doing the only thing she could, but after a few hours, when a pair of women came in and unpeeled him from her chest, she reached for him with horror, and her skin went cold in the empty air. And the thing was, her skin never stopped feeling cold, ever again, as if her infant Joey were some kind of phantom limb. She needed to know that he was okay. That was all. Which was why, some years later, as his 18th birthday approached, Maya made a trip to the Vital Records office, without Rohan's knowledge, to see if Joey had also expressed interest in meeting.
"It may never happen," Irene had cautioned her. "It usually doesn't."
But Irene's skepticism turned out to be misplaced. A few days after Joey's 18th birthday, Maya received a certified letter from the Vital Records office stating that Joseph Edward Molina had requested and been given her contact information. In the days that followed, Maya nearly lost her head. She began checking the mail all the time, not only out of eagerness and excitement, but also because she was terrified that Rohan might intercept a letter from Joey and learn that she'd been secretly rummaging around in the past. And then, one morning, in the shop's mailbox, she found an envelope from her boy, Joseph E. Molina, tucked between a utility bill and an appliance catalog. She rushed into the bathroom to read it. The last news she'd ever heard about Joey was that he'd been taken in as an infant by a generous couple who ran a household bursting with other adopted kids. This meager bit of information had always been a source of comfort to Maya,
which was why the return address on Joey's letter hit her with such sadness and shock. It had been mailed from a state penitentiary in the mountains. She was so mortified that she could hardly rip the letter open, and when she did, Joey's words only reinforced her horror. Her baby was in prison. The letter exchange began. Rather than chronicle each step or stage of his life, Joey shared wide swaths of his experience in the foster system, beginning with his broken adoption from the Molina family, but left out his struggles with depression and his inability to feel close to anyone. He asked her a lot of questions, most of which she ignored, especially the ones that concerned his father. "He passed away before you were born," she wrote, and that was the first and only reference she ever offered about Mr. O'Toole. More than anything, Maya wanted to go see her young son in prison, to embrace him and stroke his cheeks and begin the long act of apologizing for casting him into the world. Yet, she also knew that it was unrealistic for her to make even a single visit. One day was all she needed, but it was too complicated to coordinate the lying and the transportation. What reason could she give to her husband for being away? That she was attending a conference? In what? Donut making? Gas pumping? That she was having a spa day? She could not come up with a single believable reason to be away from Rohan. Why would that boy, she asked herself, even want a mother like her? Even so, Maya loved exchanging letters with Joey. Although she worried that their contact might threaten to upend her life at the donut shop, she also realized, with no small degree of guilt, that there was a certain safety in his imprisonment. Joey was her child, yes, but he was like her child in a playpen in a distant part of the house, occupying her heart, but not threatening to interrupt her dinner party, tyrannical though it was. This allowed her to encourage their relationship in a way she might otherwise have not. In her letters, she chronicled Raj's various school achievements, their daily routine around Colfax, things Joey would ask Tomas about during their nights on Level 3, Lydia realized, without ever mentioning his newly discovered mother, and put an upbeat spin on her life. She hardly mentioned Rohan. After a year and a half or so, Joey was due to be released, and Maya was worried. In her last letters to Joey in prison, she stressed the importance of keeping their relationship a secret, of giving her the space to figure out how he fit into her present life. She had an older son who didn't even know of Joey's existence, and a husband who was unaware that she had tracked him down. It was imperative that he stay away. And for a long time, Joey did. Maya talked to him briefly on the phone sometimes, and encouraged him to keep out of trouble and to do well in his rehabilitation programs. She told him that she hoped, one day, to meet him in person, just not now. Never now. But the postponements went on for too long, and both of them knew it. Joey grew tired of Maya avoiding their reunion, and she grew tired of trying to keep him hidden. She began to dodge his phone calls, and sensed a side of him that she'd been happy to ignore before. That of a solemn, desperate boy whose very desperation made people want to avoid him. At that point, Maya began to receive calls from Irene, who wanted to know if there was anything she could do to facilitate the meeting. Apparently, Joey had made a habit of stopping in to see her and begging her to do things that were well beyond her authority. Maya told Irene she had no business calling, that it was bad enough that Joey wouldn't respect her wishes. She knew what Rohan was capable of. And she knew that she'd made herself available to Joey when she was really not available. Her feelings were real, but she had no room for that boy in her life. Just a few weeks ago, Maya finally agreed to meet Joey for an early dinner at a Mexican restaurant on South Broadway. All afternoon at the donut shop, she faked groaning trips to the bathroom, then asked Rohan if he could possibly finish up the shift while she went home to rest. He reluctantly agreed, and she hopped a cab straight to the restaurant. On the cab ride over, she vowed to tell Joey, in no uncertain terms, that he should try to create his own life, separate from her. But when she reached the restaurant and stood on the sidewalk outside, peering through the window at Joey's quiet table, her heart fell into her feet. Seeing her grown-up baby for the first time in person, with his thick black hair, his long arms, his slender neck, She was floored by how unmistakably he was her son.
Through the window, Maya watched Joey rub his teeth with his finger and stir his salsa with a tortilla chip. Every few seconds he'd touch a button on his suit coat or the knot of his tie, clearly uncomfortable in those grown-up clothes. She'd last seen him in the delivery room when he was less than 1 day old, and she realized that all of his days since then had been turned over to the world, and even from here she could see that the world had not been merciful. She wanted to scoop him up and protect him, but that was impossible, so she turned up the sidewalk and walked away from the restaurant, sobbing, and made it home before Rohan had even locked the shop. Maya should have expected it the next afternoon when Joey showed up at Gas and Donuts. He was wearing his black jeans and his black hoodie, and he sat on a stool at the counter. Raj had stopped in for a short visit and was sitting by himself in the corner booth, looking through the want ads. Rohan was in the storage room in the back, emptying giant pillows of flour into 5-gallon bins. With his scrawny frame and nauseating quivers, Maya first mistook Joey for an addict, but when he pulled back his hood, she recognized him immediately. Her first reaction was one of not fear but excitement. She gasped. Raj looked up from his newspaper. Maya was standing next to the coffee pots behind the counter, so only 10 feet separated her from her youngest son. As she began to walk in his direction, Joey's green eyes brightened, and she was filled with the same love she'd felt when he was born. And then she heard Rohan's voice coming from the kitchen doorway.
Maya!
Raj shifted. Rohan pushed the door fully open.
Maya, I'll do this. Can you finish the flour?
Maya froze in place. She could feel the tiled floor tilting beneath her, sliding her toward the kitchen's swinging door. All of her feelings were consumed by fear as Joey's gaze shifted from his mother to this man, this burly stranger his mom must have loved. Across the shop, Raj set down his newspaper. From his booth, he would have been able to see the back of the scrawny young man at the counter and his father walking over and leaning into his face.
Out.
Maya hovered before the door. She could have stepped forward and said something. She could have acknowledged her younger son. But instead she disappeared into the kitchen. She told herself she was remaining silent in order to protect Raj, but choosing him over his baby brother only made her feel worse. When the door closed behind her, it felt as if it had closed upon her life. Ever since Joey's birth, if she shut her eyes and concentrated, she could smell him, like he was still that infant in her arms. And that was what she did right then, all alone in the kitchen. Even from there, she could hear the squeaky spin of the counter stool as Joey stood and ran toward the exit. The bell rang against the glass as the door shut behind him.
He's a thief, Rohan said to Raj.
Maya leaned against the tiled wall for a long time after Joey was gone, forcing herself to recall every detail of his face, his hair, his clothing, his gait, and after a time, she heard Raj gathering his things, zipping his knapsack and heading out as well.
Tell Mom I'll call, he said.
The bell rang against the glass and her other son was gone. Rohan turned over the closed sign and came into the kitchen. He'd clearly known who Joey was the moment he saw him, or maybe the moment he saw Maya looking at him. He even seemed to have expected him, which made her wonder if he'd intercepted one of their letters or phone calls. She didn't dare ask.
How long have you two been in touch? He said.
Rohan was so calm, standing there, that Maya thought the years had maybe changed him, that maybe he would allow Joey to have a place in their lives. She must have seemed happy when she told him that she and Joey had been writing letters for a few years, but that this was really the first time they'd seen each other in person. Rohan nodded along until she was finished.
If I see him again, here or anywhere, I will kill him, and then I will kill you.
Rohan, he needs a family, that's all. We could provide that.
You act like you don't believe me.
His calm was reassuring, so she tried to plead with him.
Rohan, he's my child.
Okay.
He's my son.
okay already.
He nodded with what seemed to be understanding, then held out his hand to her, open-palmed. She was nervous, but she took his hand and allowed him to walk her gently over to the stainless steel mixing station, with its vats of sugar and flour, its deep fryer and cooling racks and industrial mixer. He stopped there, then held her bicep with one hand, her forearm with the other, almost as if he were leading her onto a dance floor, except then he tightened his grip and plunged her hand into the bubbling oil of the deep fryer. Her eyes opened so wide that she felt like her lids had peeled back over the top of her head. She watched her fingers loosen as he pulled her hand, dripping and glistening out of the golden oil. Stars stirred in her vision. Skin slid off of her hand like an unfurled glove.
"Do you believe me now?"
he said. Now she could feel it, her entire hand blaring an unfathomable noise. She was unable to breathe, let alone respond. He let go and walked toward the shop's rear door, just as he had that night 20 years ago.
"Please don't hurt him."
"Get that hand fixed before we open tomorrow."
In the shop with Lydia, Mrs. Patel fiddled with her gray gauzy mitten.
"Please don't hurt him," she said. "That was all I could offer my son. That was the extent of my motherhood. 4 words. Please don't hurt him."
After Rohan left the shop, Maya made 2 phone calls, one to get the taxi that would take her to the emergency room because her husband had just driven off in his Monte Carlo, and the other to Joey, who had just arrived at his group home apartment and picked up his ringing phone. He was silent as Mrs. Patel spoke the last words she would ever say to him.
"I never want to see you again. I never want to hear from you. I never want to read your letters. Am I making myself clear?"
"Mom?"
"Don't call me that. It's not your fault, but some people are just not meant to be born. If I could undo you, I would. I promise you, I would."
As she set down the receiver, she could hear him saying, "Mom?"
"That hurt far more than my hand ever could," Mrs. Patel said to Lydia. "But I didn't know how else I might protect him. Rohan would be glad to kill him."
Lydia imagined Joey hanging up the phone, then sitting in his empty apartment with his pile of books, ignoring Lyle's calls and his landlady's knocks. His whole life he had turned to books as his only solace, so it made sense that in preparing to undo himself he would do the same, fall into their pages, disappear into their windows, expose his soul on his way out of life. She could have asked Mrs. Patel for more details, but she knew enough. After that final phone call, Joey had spent 2 or 3 days carving his messages, and each piece of a page he sliced inched him ever closer to death.
"I-O, we, or eth, and his eldia but I'd on the, huvet, or dis, any, more, reth, a, have been tack, in along, with my, l, f. I owe you more than this, Lydia, but I don't have the words anymore. They have been taken along with my life."
Mrs. Patel looked drained and scared on her upturned bucket. She seemed to be asking Lydia for forgiveness, or at least for understanding. But it wasn't Lydia's to give.
"You don't even know why I'm here," Lydia said.
"Because you and Raj found out about Joey," Mrs. Patel said, but there was a lilt of doubt in her voice.
"I will make it up to him, Lydia. Maybe now that Raj knows, we can find a way. I will make it up to him."
"You can't," Lydia said.
"I can, Lydia. I just don't know how yet."
Lydia had been so caught up in this knot of secrets that she'd nearly forgotten why she'd stepped foot into the Vital Records office last week in the first place, to track down Joey's mother in order to share the news of his suicide. She deserved to know, Lydia had told herself then. After all, his mother had been seeking him out.
You can't make it up to him, she said, because Joey is dead. He hanged himself in the bookstore where I work.
No, he didn't.
Check the newspaper. Joey hanged himself. That's why I'm here, Mrs. Patel. I came to tell you that your boy is dead.
He's not, Lydia. I saw him,
when?
3 weeks ago?
Less than 3 weeks.
What is today?
Lydia could see her struggling with her own denial, but the certainty of her words had broken through. Mrs. Patel's mittened hand clutched at a phantom spot on her chest.
Joey's heart was already broken, Lydia said, and you broke it again. He couldn't recover this time.
I will make it up to him.
It's too late.
Lydia opened the door to the alley. She heard voices out there, and in a moment of terror expected to see Mr. Patel, but it was only a homeless couple pushing a shopping cart through the slush. Just beyond them, across the alley, was the rusty old ladder bolted to the side of the motel. It hurt to remember Raj in his buckled jumpsuit, climbing rung by rung to its top and pouring a curtain of powdery creamer as little Carol held out her pack of matches below. Lydia was glad that it wasn't Mr. Patel she'd heard in the alley. He'd killed Mr. and Mrs. O'Toole, and he'd killed her friend Carol, and he'd killed the broken Joey, or at least caused him to die, and it only took one look at Mrs. Patel to see all the damage he'd done to her as well. Before she could face him, or call Moberg or the police, she promised herself she'd first speak with Raj, empty herself of all these secrets, and maybe even figure out a way to shield her father from the secrets he'd kept as well.
I will make it up to him, Mrs. Patel said.
Joey deserved a better mother than you, Lydia said, buttoning her coat and stepping out the door.
I will make it up to him, Mrs. Patel repeated,
but Lydia was already trudging through the alley slush, glancing at the ladder, thinking about the fiery flower, warm and alive, that her friend Carol had conjured from the air. Epilogue. On the night before Thanksgiving, Lydia's ghost appeared on television. At the time, she was in the kitchen, pulling down boxes of stuffing and cans of yams and periodically slapping the cold pimpled turkey thawing in her sink. From where she stood, she could see Raj in the other room, wearing a gray wool sweater and cut-off army pants. He thumbed the TV remote.
Maybe nothing good is on, she said.
Something good is always on.
Raj had offered to come over and help get the meal ready, but since he didn't have cable yet in his new apartment, he'd gone straight for her remote. To save a little money, Lydia had planned on getting rid of cable when David moved out 6 months ago, but Raj had been coming around often enough that she'd postponed making the call. He would watch just about anything, the cheesier the better, but she usually didn't mind. For all the perks of living alone, one downside was how long the nights could sometimes feel with no one there to grasp. Her dad would be coming over for the holiday tomorrow as well. His first trip to Denver in 2 decades. Lydia hadn't seen him in person since last winter's visit to Rio Vista, but he'd been calling every Sunday like clockwork, and she was usually glad to hear his voice. Most of the time they kept their conversations away from anything too substantial, but at one point during the summer, after a few beers at a Bright Ideas barbecue, she'd bravely suggested that he turn his cabin into a used bookstore, since he had plenty of inventory already, and Rio Vista could sure use a... He hung up the phone before she even finished. Their calls continued, but neither of them ever mentioned the used bookstore idea again. By way of an apology, she mailed him an assortment of reading glasses. Lydia had hoped to invite David over for Thanksgiving dinner as well, but he wouldn't even return her calls, and she really couldn't blame him. The original plan, last spring, hers anyway, had been for them to try living apart for a while just as a test, to see what would happen if they had some distance between them. After discovering that he'd known for years, in silence about little Lydia, she'd been spotting his faults all over, and losing her ability to overlook them. If the two of them were meant to be, she reasoned, they'd be drawn to each other again like a pair of cranes or vultures, ready to mate for life. David begrudgingly agreed,
and she helped him get set up in a studio apartment near the University of Denver, a bit closer to his office. Those first weeks of separate living had invigorated them as a couple, as if the arrangement had merely given them a new place to have sex and a new neighborhood to grab coffee. But something happened once the first month wore off. David gradually stopped inviting her over to his studio, claiming perhaps rightly that spending all of that time together felt too much like cheating on their agreement, and within another month, he'd come right out and accused her of trying to have it both ways. He had plenty to offer, he said, and if she didn't want all of him, she couldn't have any of him. It hurt how right he was. By the time Halloween rolled around, he'd gone totally cold. David would not be spending Thanksgiving with Lydia and her father, but she was comforted by the fact that Raj would be there. And Raj was comforted, too. For the first time in his life, he had nowhere else to go. 10 months ago, the day after leaving Mrs. Patel at Gas and Donuts, Lydia had been organizing a pile of board books in the kids' section when Plath approached, wearing flip-flops and a skirt she'd made from a shower curtain. She held out the morning paper and bit her lip. "If it's another picture of me," Lydia said, gesturing to the newspaper, "I don't even want to know." "You look tired," Plath said. "I'll come back." "What is it?" "It's bad, really bad. Murder at the donut shop, bad." Lydia was supposed to meet Raj for breakfast this morning, but he hadn't answered her calls. She assumed he'd spent all night poring over Irene's files and needed to catch up on his sleep, but now her heart began to pound. "What happened?" she said. "What murder?" "Late last night at Gas and Donuts. That's your friend's place, right?" Lydia felt herself falling into a panic, thinking first about Raj, then about Mrs. Patel. Then she was unable to think at all. She grabbed the paper out of Plath's hands. "Who got killed? Who?" "The guy who owned the shop," Plath said. "Your friend's dad? He's dead." Lydia's hands were so shaky that Plath had to spread open the pages for her to read. "Local business owner slain in late-night robbery." "You okay?" Plath asked. Lydia frantically read the article. She learned that after dropping his deposit bag into the after-hours slot at the bank, Mr. Patel had returned to Gas and Donuts to pick up his wife and finish locking up. When he stepped out of his Monte Carlo, someone emerged from the darkness behind the dumpsters and shot him multiple times in the back, then in the head. The police were speculating that the shooter wanted the deposits and panicked when it was discovered that Mr. Patel had already been to the bank. A passing driver may have seen someone walking away on foot, but no further information was known about the assailant. "Maybe you should go over to the donut shop," Plath said. "Pay your respects." "I don't have any respects." The hammer man was dead, and Lydia's immediate reaction had been to rush to a phone and try calling Raj again to find out if he knew, what he knew, and to see if there was anything she could do to help. All afternoon, his phone rang and his answering machine didn't pick up, and even when she stopped by his apartment on the way home from work, no one answered the door. She considered calling Gas and Donuts or his parents' house, but couldn't bring herself to punch the digits. Early the following morning, as a few yawning book frogs lined up at Bright Ideas for their day's wordy intake, Lydia stood at the newsstand, combing through the paper for any updates. She'd barely dented the metro section when Raj came rushing across the floor and landed smack in the center of her embrace.
"Raj, my God, your dad."
"I know."
"How's your mom?"
"They got her," he said.
"What?"
"The police. They got her."
Then he collapsed into sobs and had to plant his hand against the magazine racks in order to stop himself from falling sideways.
"They took her, Lydia. They took my mom."
Raj didn't tip over, but he did end up with one arm around Lydia's shoulder as they hobbled to a table in the coffee shop. Raj had been at his mom's side nonstop during the 32 hours since the shooting. But it wasn't until the two of them had been called into the station near City Park for yet another informational session that one of the detectives, a young guy with big ears who seemed embarrassed to be there, came into the room and asked Mrs. Patel if she wanted to enlist a lawyer. Then he presented the old Montgomery Ward 22 rifle that Mr. Patel had kept under the gas and donuts counter for years. The rookie had barely even placed it on the table before asking Mrs. Patel if she had any idea how it had ended up in the dumpster behind the shop. She did, she told him, and yes, she would very much like that lawyer now. Years ago, it was Mr. Patel who'd advised her that in the event of a life-threatening situation, she should yank back the slide, aim the rusty rifle, and pull the trigger until the tube was empty. Spray and pray, he'd called it, and that's exactly what she had done behind the dumpsters that night, just after Lydia left the shop, waited for her husband to step out of his car, then fired. 3 bullets hit his back, 2 hit his head, and 5 hit the car, though not in that order. Then she ditched the gun and called the police.
They let me stay with her for a while as we waited for the lawyer, Raj said, and she told me everything.
Everything? Raj wouldn't look Lydia in the eye.
Enough, anyway. It won't be long before she tells the police everything, too. It's like she wanted to get caught.
Lydia considered asking Raj what he'd meant by enough, but he seemed so distraught that she knew this wasn't the time. She thought about the last words Mrs. Patel had said to her on the slushy night of the shooting as she exited the donut shop. I will make it up to him. To Joey, her lost son. She'd tried. There at the coffee shop, Lydia bought Raj a pastry and a bottle of juice. They sat together for a long time, mostly in silence, and when he left the store that afternoon, he put on a pair of sunglasses and gave her a clumsy kiss on the cheek. On the way out, he bumped into a table of books. For Lydia, Mr. Patel's murder had reaffirmed something that she'd been gradually facing up to her entire life. The Hammer Man would always be with her. He occupied an immeasurable space inside her that would never be altered by the outside world, not by rifle shots or a therapist's couch or a child's tiny grip on her finger. And, paradoxical though it was, the reliability of this had always offered her some strange semblance of identity. Even if Mr. Patel was forever gone, the Hammer Man would always be out there, and Lydia would always be that girl beneath the sink. Always little Lydia. Which was why what happened to her on the night before Thanksgiving felt so unexpected. She'd been in the kitchen, drinking a glass of the wine that Raj had brought, plunging her hand into the turkey, and trying to pry out a bag of giblets that were still frozen to its cavity, when Raj abruptly stopped changing channels.
Are you seeing this? He said, his voice eager and unsteady. Lydia, quick, come in here.
Lydia was up to her elbow in the turkey, but when she looked at the television, she could see a static image of the O'Toole's small, familiar house. Without washing her hands, she stepped toward the couch. She felt her skin tighten, and everything but the screen faded away. A buried phrase crackled from the television. Little Lydia, the voice said. Only it had been sifted through an accent and surrounded by rolling Spanish. Little Lydia.
What is this? Raj said, turning to look at her. Should we turn it off?
Turn it up.
It's in Spanish, he said, looking at the remote. Some kind of ghost hunting show? Do you even get this channel?
No idea. Most of what appeared on the screen was filmed through an obnoxious green night vision camera that tracked through the O'Toole's house in the dark. In the center of the green, a flashlight halo dragged over the carpet and the walls and the pictures and the doors. The production values were painfully low, yet she could see that the O'Toole's orange shag carpet had been replaced by a speckled brown Berber, and that all the fixtures had been updated. Otherwise, the layout of the home was almost exactly the same, as if the new family were working from the blueprints of the old. Raj covered his mouth with his hand.
Oh my God, he said. That's inside Carol's house?
Lydia could only nod. The host of the program was a histrionic 30-something with slick black hair and a black leather jacket. As he walked through the house, he whispered into the camera, periodically raising a finger and allowing his eyes to roam from wall to wall, floor to ceiling. He opened closet doors and peeled back the shower curtain and occasionally the screen would cut to a close-up of the ghostometer, a ridiculous contraption that looked like a mix between an old-fashioned radio and a pasta colander. An outdated oscilloscope screen attached to the device showed a glowing flat line of inactivity, at least until he carried it into the hallway just near the master bedroom doorway. The host looked at the camera with wide eyes when the beeps grew frantic and the display showed a flurry of green waves.
"I guess that means there's a ghost," Raj mumbled.
Lydia felt her heart pounding, and every few seconds she felt someone blowing gently on the back of her neck. As the host continued down the hall, the screen showed grainy photographs of each of the O'Tooles one at a time. Bart first, then Dottie, and finally Carol. Then, the camera focused on a girl with straight black hair, 12 or 13 years old, wearing a pink sweatshirt and fidgeting in an overstuffed chair. The girl obviously now lived in Carol's old house, and she was being interviewed about a ghost who lived in her hallway, the ghost that this show was apparently there to find. As the girl spoke to the camera, the voice of a translator crowded over her words, but she could still be heard faintly in English beneath.
"Sometimes," she said, "in the middle of the night, I can hear someone crawling fast through my hallway. Only no one is there when I look."
Lydia's first reaction was to feel terrified for this girl, but when she saw the smile on her face, like she was trying not to laugh, like she was doing this on a dare, she realized that this was more about entertainment than fear.
"One night," the girl continued, "I was getting a drink of water, and I could hear someone breathing inside the sink."
The screen cut to a night vision view of the O'Toole's kitchen. Slow and unsteady, the camera roamed over the humming refrigerator, the scuffed baseboards, and finally, the cabinet beneath the sink. Lydia could hear the voices of the girl and her translator behind the images.
"The story I heard at school was this one girl hid under there all night. She didn't get killed because she was so hidden. But in the morning, no one could find her. Like she just disappeared into thin air."
"Little Lydia."
On the screen, the host's hand reached out, opening the cabinet beneath. It was apparently inconvenient for the producers to show the famous photograph of Lydia being carried off the neighbor's porch by her father, surrounded by police and paramedics. That would break the paranormal narrative they were creating. What they showed instead was the host's hand lowering the ghostometer into the dark space beneath the sink. Inside, below the disposal, she could see grimy pipes and a pair of crusty shut-off valves. The space was crowded with cleaning products and a roll of trash bags, and her stomach dropped at the thought of folding herself tightly enough to fit inside. Predictably, the machine's oscilloscope lit up, splashing green waves, screeching beeps, proving undeniably that there was a ghost under there. Lydia felt her body stiffen. She could sense Raj swaying against the couch.
"She was in there forever," the girl's voice continued, "and then she was just gone."
On the screen, a hand pressed closed the cabinet door. Ka-tick.
"I can't watch this," Raj said, grimacing. He lifted the remote. "Can I?"
"Please."
In an instant, the television blinked to black. Raj tossed the remote to the couch and closed his eyes.
"Raj, you okay?"
"Not at all," he said. "You?"
"Me neither," she said, holding her elbows. "That was weird."
"Really weird. I'm never watching television again."
She laughed uncomfortably, and after a moment, Raj did too. Then he slowly reached out and took her hand and pulled her into an unexpected hug, despite the turkey juice sticky on her arm.
"You're not a ghost," he said.
"No?"
Lydia smelled his clean skin and felt the warmth and comfort of his body, and though she wanted to close her eyes and feel the promise of this moment, she couldn't help but look beyond his shoulder, hoping to see for one last time the girl he'd just erased from the screen.
Midnight at the Bright Ideas Bookstore, a novel, was written by Matthew Sullivan and read by Madeline Mabee. Editing and post-production by Like 2000 Pounds.